Hi, you're listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life with me, your host, Mimi Novick. I'm so happy and thrilled to have you here with me. I have created this series for all of us so we can change our world together and live a more holistic and balanced life. Together, we will share lots of inspiring stories from all walks of life, speak with leading experts, enjoy healthy living ideas, explore music and subjects that inspire each other to always have hope. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Secrets for an Inspirational Life. How are you all today? I hope that this day finds you well. I hope that wherever you are, there are some beautiful moments that are arriving, and that all the sadnesses that we all have at times in our life leave. And sometimes when sad things happen, we think that we will never be able to lift ourselves up again. But believe me, we have to, because our heart and our soul is something that's far greater than whatever happens to us. And it doesn't really matter what the day is like, what the week is like. We have to have hope. And even today, as I look out of the window, and it's very gloomy and very rainy, I always think to myself, you can't wait for the sunny days just to live your life. You have to live your life in every moment. And it is such a gift, such a profoundly special gift, that we never know what's around the corner. Therefore, let's embrace each other and let's embrace life and enjoy those moments together. Now, I have to say to you, I am absolutely delighted and rather excited to welcome my guest today, who is the very interesting Tony Klinger. Tony is an award-winning international filmmaker of inspiring documentaries, rockumentaries, and films and TV. He is also an acclaimed author, a screenplay writer, and a playwright. He began his career as assistant director on The Avengers in the 1960s. He has made over 100 films worldwide, ranging from documentaries to cinema feature films and TV movies in more than 30 countries. Tony worked in partnership with his father, the legendary film producer Michael Klinger, who made such films as Get Carter, Repulsion, and Cul-de-sac, and as well as many other major productions. He has worked with major stars from the film and music industries, such as The Who, Michael Caine, Lee Marvin, Roger Moore, Deep Purple, Peter Ustinov, Jack Nicholson, and the list goes on and on. His work has won him many international awards, among which are the Queen's Anniversary Prize for Education, the London Film Festival, and the San Sebastian Film Festival, to name but a few. I don't really know how I can fit everything in, but hopefully today he will share his extraordinary life journey. Welcome, dear Tony.
Thank you. When I hear those lists of things, so-called achievements, it actually feels like it must be somebody else. But all of the things you said are true. But I don't list them like that for myself. I kind of think about what's coming rather than what's been. But I suppose you have to give some kind of attitude about the past. And all I can say about my past really is that I enjoyed it greatly, and I hope somebody else did too.
Oh, well, I'm absolutely honoured to have you here, Tony. And yes, As I said to the listeners out there, your life is remarkable. And the things that you have achieved are really exceptional. So I understand life is about moving forward and looking forward, but it really does make a difference to us as people to actually acknowledge our achievements. So I think it's wonderful what you have achieved and yet still have lots to achieve.
Well, thank you for that. I think my wife might disagree because she'd like me to stop doing so much, but I enjoy what I do. I wake up happy and thrilled to face those challenges. I mean, it is a wonderful life when one is doing something that other people can enjoy, maybe learn from, be entertained, educated, whatever. And it's a joy for me, particularly, that I can do the things that I feel passionate about, to tell stories that I feel life enhancing or at least satisfying to share. And it's easy to fall into a pattern. I remember when I started, for a period from the late 1990s to the early 2000s, I went into academia for a while, and I tried to be more academic in the way I responded to questions. And I remember the students came to me after a while and they went, "Tell us the stories. Tell us what happened. What was it like to work with so-and-so? What did it take to put that film together?" And really, we all share a very common but not non-attributable feeling that we actually goes back to whoever the shaman was, the storyteller, in a cave when they would light the fire, and the person who sat down and told everybody the stories of what was the stars meant, what was happening, what happened on a hunt. And basically that's what I am. I'm a storyteller, I'm a shaman.
I think that's wonderful, because actually when I was looking through all the things that you do, and as I said, the list is a very long list and an endless list. And for me, you are like a storyteller. That's actually how I envisage you to be, which is the storyteller that has so many different stories. And storytelling is one of the oldest forms of actually teaching people. So, in, you know, from times gone by, hundreds of years ago, they were always the most entertaining as well, when you had the storytellers in the royal courts that would, you know, amuse the king and the sultans of long ago. So they had a very important role to play.
Well, I think that's true. I don't think I'm a court jester, but I'm getting some like so. But I feel that what happens is that it's something that burns within certain people. Like some people are born to be comedians or runners or footballers or something. I was born to tell stories usually by writing. And it all started from writing. And then the thing that disciplined me about my writing was that I was fortunate enough to get taught to be an editor, a film editor. And that tells you how to formulate a story. One thing writing it, another one to get it in a form that's acceptable. And so those things combined in me I started telling stories on paper from when I was 8 years old. I just knew what I wanted to do. I never had any doubt. And it's strange because in my family, although my father became a film producer much later, he was a structural engineer. And his father was a tailor's presser immigrant from Poland. And so it's not something that was in my family. All my family in America, everywhere, almost 80, 90% of them were engineers. I kind of let them down.
Oh, I'm sure you didn't. So, look, this life of yours, this story within a story within a story, a little bit like the 1001 Arabian Nights, I feel. It sounds like that. And I wanted to ask you, actually, before we go on, have you written a book about all of these legendary meetings and things?
I'm writing it right now. Yeah, I've got several books coming out in the coming year, 2 years, and one of them is my memoirs. I didn't want to write it like a biography, autobiography, because I felt that it would fill up many, many volumes. I wrote one book about me making the film about the making the film The Kids Are All Right with The Who, and the third edition of which is coming out in the first quarter of next year, called Who Knows? And that was a whole book about one incident, about one film. And as you said, I've made lots of films with lots of famous people. And so I could have, I don't know, 40 books. So I don't think anybody would want that. So what I've done is telling incidents about travel, or incidents about politics, or incidents about filmmaking or music making, things that I've been involved in. But sometimes, very strangely, I feel like that character Zelig, that appears in places where you think, what's he doing there? Why is he in that picture? And I've actually been in some ridiculous situations. I think because I was a person that was somewhat personable, I can get on with people. And what happens is somebody says, oh, that guy's, he travels a lot, he might be useful for this. And so I get asked things to do, and some of it completely outside of the realm of the things you think I should be doing.
Now that you're talking, of course you must remember Edward Woodward in The Equalizer.
Of course.
Yeah, and you're a little bit like that.
Running around killing people.
Well, no, but you can fix things.
I don't know if I can fix them, or other people think I can fix them, which could be a different thing. But I've been asked to do sometimes things that are just ridiculous. And my attitude is, from a very young age, that I thought, and it's so inappropriate, so wrong, I thought I could do anything. I actually, kind of thought, well, if I wanted to swim very fast, I could be the best swimmer in the world. Or if I wanted to run very fast, I'd be the fastest runner. Till I actually did it, and then somebody could go past me like I'm standing still. But certain things I can do. And certainly I felt I was more than adequately able to write or tell stories or produce a film. I could do it. And one of my inabilities was to understand when somebody else couldn't. Because to me, I couldn't understand, well, why can't you do that? It's like obvious. And then as you grow older, you grow a bit wiser, and you realize, well, that actually is a bit of a stupid thing to think. But you don't know that when you're a kid. And so I went for everything. I never thought, when somebody said, can you do the sound on something? We were kids. And I went, yeah, of course I can. I had no idea. I learned real fast, and I remember how upset I grew a moustache when I was about 17 to look older. And the sound man on the Avengers had heard that I'd been borrowing equipment, sound equipment, and using it. And he was furious. He said, "I've been in this business 35 years, and you young, well, I won't use the word he used." He said, "And you think you can do it?" And I said, "No, I can do it. I know I can do it." And yeah, I couldn't do it as well as him, but I knew I could do it adequately to get to where I wanted. And it's like what they call in America a can-do attitude. I felt like I can do these things. And I didn't even, when I was a director of Media Production Centre in the University of East London, and we had, I don't know, 3,000 kids using our facilities, and I was director of three departments there, I knew I couldn't have an in-depth knowledge of every piece of software that exists, because it's impossible. But I could have a knowledge of it, and I could have a shallow but broad knowledge of it, and that's what I needed. I didn't need to be an expert on every piece. And to try and do so, you'd be not very good at everything. And so what I've learned is, it's something you either can do or not. It's to discern what is important to me and to the project I'm on, and then to be able to deliver on that.
Listening to you, it's so fascinating, Tony, because I think maybe that's the secret, actually. Maybe there's some real hidden secret there to life of having this will and having this want and the belief in oneself that you can do it that has actually now enabled you to have done so many things? Is that the secret?
Well, maybe I did them all wrong, and maybe I was lousy at them. I don't know. It's how you perceive things as against how other people perceive things. I remember when we were winning a ton of awards at the Bournemouth and Northern Film Schools, of which I was fortunate to be a course leader and things like that. And, you know, I remember other places were jealous of it. And I've never been jealous of anybody else's success. I love it. And the reason I love it is as a consequence of common sense. If somebody else, for example, has a very big hit film, that means there's more money in the business for everybody to make more films. It doesn't mean it's diminishing me. It's increasing my opportunities. So I applaud other people's success. I'm not competing with them. I'm competing with me.
That's wise advice. And it's something very noble. I don't think many people have that attitude, but I think it's because you have that attitude is that you have been so successful in life.
Well, it wasn't. I remember when I was in academia and I realised at a certain point when we were having some new buildings built, I won't say the name of the university, at a university, and we raised a lot of money for that. And one of the lecturers from another department said to me, he said, I can't stand that you're doing that. And I went, why? He said, because if you get 12 chairs in one of your rooms, that means I've got 12 less chairs. I said, no, it means we've got 12 chairs we can share. And he couldn't bear it. And it was that attitude of and that's what happens in academia, and I'm sure in every other big institution, is that you have these, I used to call them feudal baronesses, and each one of us was on a charger in our suit of armour, trying to fight them off so that we could make a bigger baronessy for ourselves. And it's really, really stupid, because the word collegiate means you should be working together. But it doesn't happen like that. It really doesn't. And our system means that you can go to a university, to work against, I won't say names, where you can have five big departments of schools within the university, and three of or four of them could be terrible and one of them could be fantastic. It's because that guy won that battle.
Yeah. And are you still working in the universities, or is that something, because I know you do coaching.
We do coaching and we do some teaching and we do mentoring of interns. And we also I do, to keep my hand in really, some classes at universities. I'm not though a full-time employee. I just do spec things and talks and workshops and stuff like that.
Because you've won quite a few awards.
Yeah, we won.
For your work.
Well, I think it's a misnomer to say I won. Our team won. There's a whole bunch of people involved when you win one of those awards. I remember one person thinking, at one stage we won 9, I think, of awards that were available out of 11 from the Fuji, or one of those big prizes that used to be for film students. And I was getting up every time they said, and we've got an award for the best film, or the best photography, or the best, and we were winning them, almost all of them. And the guy behind me from another university went, quietly, but I heard him, he's like, how's he do it? What's it like, cheating? It's like, I said, no. I said, it cost me a fortune to bribe all those judges. and it was because we had a very simple policy, which was we recruited the best possible people and then motivated them and let them run free.
That is lovely.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's common sense. You have to create a framework, because everybody needs some kind of framework. Mm. But within that framework, you say, right, there isn't just my way or your way. There is the way we do this thing. You know, making a film, for example, is like a factory creating problems. It's really difficult. But every time the problems are different. They're within the same framework, but the things you have to do to deal with them will always be different. And that's why it becomes infinitely interesting.
And you have, I know, some films that you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, we've just finished the sound work on a film called Dirty, Sexy and Totally Iconic, which is a film, our film, very personal film, about me doing a search for the history of the film of my father, that's the most famous film of his, called Get Carter with Michael Caine. And that was delightful. It was difficult. It was supposed to be doing it for the 50th anniversary of the film, but it became the 50th anniversary plus COVID. And right in the middle, that's when it hit. And so we literally just finished it. And so that'll be coming up ne next year, 24. We have another film that came out 2 months ago called Sisters, which is on Amazon, as is The Man Who Got Carter. The Man Who Got Carter is actually my love letter to my father. It's about his life and career as a filmmaker. He was the best film producer I ever met. And then Sisters was a film that is directed by a boy called, a man, sorry, boy is not, but that's not kind, called Dan Blackwell, musician. And he went to Kabul, Afghanistan, just before the Taliban came back, and made a film in the music academy there with the Zohra Orchestra, Zohra, which was the first, and unfortunately will be the last, all-female orchestra in Afghanistan. And it's a story about those young women and girls and their story of how, despite everything, they managed to learn their instruments and perform around the world, etc., until the Taliban came in. And the first thing the Taliban did was go destroy the school as a school and smash up all the instruments. And the girls, we felt we had to wait till the girls were out safely for different countries, which they now are. And so those two films are both on Amazon and many other platforms available now.
And are you actually starring in them, or did you produce them?
Produced Sisters, executive produced it, and the other one I'm a presenter producer, and I'm actually in it a lot.
Oh,
Yeah, it's me conducting this.
well, I'm going to have a look at that later.
You
And so
will.
it's on Amazon, is it? Is it on
No, that
Netflix?
one, that Sisters is on Amazon. The Man Who Got Carter is on Amazon, so I'm in that one as well. But in Dirty Sexy, I'm in it a lot, and that one is not yet out because we just finished it.
That's in 2024. Yeah. And you mentioned your father, Michael Klinger. Now, is he the inspiration for you to have joined in the film industry? Is he the major inspiration?
No, in fact, he's an inspiration for me as a person, as my father, as because I loved him, and he actually came into the industry after I'd already decided to come into the industry, and I felt actually quite cheated by that. I didn't want him to, because I felt that's not where that's where I'm going. What are you doing that? And so we actually didn't really officially work together. I worked on a couple of his films as an associate producer, but I didn't really work with him properly till I was 35 years old. And then we worked together as partners for 3 years, and he allowed me the conceit. We had a public company in America. I had 51%, and he had 49%. It was very kind of him to allow me to do that. But he was I learned like I learned as yeah I suppose these things happen, you know, when you get older. I think if you're lucky, your father realizes what abilities you have, and you realize he's not a silly old fool like you thought. And I realized what a great guy he was, and a great film man. And he could have done anything. He was capable of doing anything. He was truly a brilliant person, in every respect. He got 14 matriculation passes, all grade one. He got into university, I think it was Cambridge, and then turned it down, pretending he did. He pretended to me that he'd never got there, and it was all, you know, his father wouldn't let him because of work and all that kind of thing, because they were poor working class people. And I found a letter that my grandfather wrote turning down the place. And then I realized my grandfather didn't read or write English. So my father had baked the letter.
Oh.
And he did strange things. He was during the war, he was in what they called a reserved occupation. He designed machines that made and tested weapons, bombs and missiles and torpedoes and stuff. And it became part of Lend-Lease. What he did became part of Lend-Lease and was very valuable, and they kept it. They didn't let him have anything. And he at the end of the war had no, he was like had no money. And he was running a factory with 2,000 men in it and was earning a couple of pounds a week. And they kept him there for a long, long time. And he always told me, yeah, I volunteered, but they wouldn't have let me. And when he died, the obituary in one of the major national newspapers said it turned out he had volunteered 11 times.
Oh, imagine that.
And got because he fancied himself to be an RAF pilot, have the moustache and the whole twirly bit at the end. And what happened was the last time he tried to volunteer to the Canadian Air Force because he thought he'd get away with that. And they said, well, if you do it again, we're going to arrest you and put you in jail because you've got to stay where you are. And so he felt he wanted to express like his abilities. And so he went into all kinds of things after the war to make money, to make a living, and then found his way in through the back door into the film business by he had a nightclub by the time I was 7 or 8 in London, and he hated it. He didn't like it at all. His partner liked to, so he would do the daytimes and the partner would run the club at night. So my dad did the admin really. For reasons I won't go into, one time it all split up and he found a venue for what he thought would be another club. And then he thought, I wonder, there's no new cinemas because after the war, there hadn't been any cinemas built in the country, new ones, into the 60s. And he was the first person to start building cinemas. And he built a cinema and he said the people that were going to be involved with him and backing him said, yeah, but you can't project in there because it's a flat surface and it's a basement with a low ceiling. And because of his engineering background, he worked out how to project through mirrors from behind the screen and managed to show films. And then they said there was a thing in England called logging and barring, which meant that if a film had been shown by a major company in London, within 7 miles, I think it was, that no one else could book that film. Or they'd be barred from any future films from those distributors. And so he couldn't get any films. And so he decided to turn the cinema into a club in which you bought membership and he showed the films for free. And that's how he got into the film business.
How resourceful.
Oh, he was very clever. He was very, very clever.
My goodness. What an extraordinary man, really.
He also had things that I didn't even know when I was a kid, like he had a photographic memory. And so when people would do a contract with him and they'd say, oh no, but the contract, he'd say, no, clause 32, page 57, line 9 says, and it completely floored the opposition. What are we dealing with? He was, well, the nearest thing I know to a genius and a wonderful sense of humour, very funny man.
And how long was he in the industry for, Tony?
He started, I guess, well, he went, so from cinemas, he built a whole bunch of cinemas really fast. And then he got into distribution because he thought, why am I paying these people to distribute films to me? I should distribute them to myself. And became within a year, like one of the biggest independent film distributors in Europe. And then I remember going, I remember one time going to his offices in Old Compton Street, and there was, I don't know, 10 people. And then I went back about a year later, and there was like 150, 200 people. It was like incredible. And then he realized, I could make these films. I could, and so he started making really terrible films. And that bit by bit, they got better and better. And then he realized, I need to up this. And because he was a cineast, he loved films. And continental cinema was his taste, like French and Italian and all that. And so he started to he so he made to step up, he made the first two English language Roman Polanski films, Repulsion and Cul-de-Sac, which you mentioned, in your interest. And it wasn't to, that wasn't to make money. That was to get considered seriously for better films. And then he went on to make bigger and better films, sold all the rest and carried on making films. So that period was from, say, 1961 to 1969, 70. And then he was, by then, in the big time. We went from, when I was born, Hackney, to the time I was 14, Grosvenor Square.
Listening to it, it's like a magical life in a way. Do you think it was, I don't know, is life to do with luck? Do you think it was just because he was lucky, or was it a bit of luck and a whole load of hard work?
Certainly he worked very hard, and he inculcated that in me. If I'm not working, I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I do love it, but I find that I'm compelled to work. He was worse. His father was worse at whatever we do. And he, I think, would have been a success at whatever he did, whenever he did it. He was an extraordinary person. And if you went in a room with him, he would dominate the room. It didn't matter who was there. And he attracted people like a magnet. It was something to see.
It is. It's such an extraordinary thing. People's personality, not just that. You know, some people have a magnetism, as you say, that it doesn't really matter what they do. They attract people to them. And that's something I don't think you can work at. That's something that you're born with. You either have it or you don't.
Absolutely. Even people, after he died, I mean, years later, people he's had fights with, I mean, you know, big arguments with, came to me at various film festivals and said how they missed my dad. I said, you were his enemy. And they went, no, but we loved him. He made everybody laugh.
And how was that sort of, because you worked with him on many productions, and did you continue that later on in life? Is it something that you took over the company, because you said that you had 1% more than him? Is it something that you carried on?
No, I did initially. I did initially after he died. There was a period where I felt I had to sort of defend his memory. And some nasty things happened. And I should have walked away. In retrospect, it's easy to say, oh, what was I doing? Was I, you know, like tilting at windmills? But that's how I felt emotionally, and I followed my emotions. Most of the time, I now recognize that when I try to logic things out, it can be wrong. But when you do it emotionally, at least it feels right, and at least you feel like you're doing the right thing. And so I now try and more listen to my emotional feelings than I do my logical feelings. Because they sometimes conflict. I don't think it was very hard to accept that people could attack somebody. For example, there was one guy who was a very, very famous writer, and he a novelist who's now dead, and he was a friend. He was the man actually that made me carry on writing professionally. I'll say his name. Wilbur Smith. And Wilbur, we were friends. And my dad helped him do his contracts to become as rich and powerful as he became.
Mm-hmm.
Overseas contracts and things. And I was there. I know it's true. And when my dad died, on the day he was being buried, they tried to do a lawsuit against us to force us to return the materials that we had. And they'd forgotten that we could read. We knew what was in the contract, so that didn't work. But it was, who sends to the funeral of a friend a writ?
Yeah.
And that's what he did. I couldn't believe it. you know, that was not even a letter of condolence. And there hadn't been a big fight. It just was him trying to score, get some better deal somewhere. And that, you know, after we'd made two of his films and made him a lot of money. But that's beside the point. It's not how you should behave. And some people, that's what they think about. That's all they think about. So I shouldn't have really, I should have just said, yeah, go get stuffed. Here it is. But I actually tried to fight the good fight because I thought I should.
That takes a extraordinary amount of courage to also, you speak about following your emotions. I always call it following my heart, because when I think of things logically or with my mind, it never makes sense. And the things that have always got me through life have been my heart and making the decision based upon what's going to give me the most peace.
Yeah, well, I think the final answer is we're here for a very short period of time. And if we don't, if we want to do something good, then that should sort of govern your life. It can't all be for gain and money and riches and cars and things. Well, I suppose when you're a kid, it could be. But when you get a bit older, you should have grown out of that. And you should be thinking there's a bigger universe out there.
And what actually inspires you, Tony, to keep carrying on and doing this work?
I love telling stories. I enjoy the doing of it. I don't enjoy the business side of it very much anymore because it's kind of boring. I know it's got to be done, but it's kind of, you know, it's I feel like AI could probably do it pretty much better than me. But the creative process fascinates me and enlivens me. And I can't stand injustice or what I perceive as injustice. I mean, it might be somebody else thinks it's the right thing. And so I get very angry. I feel very passionate about things. And so I might be mistaken, but I'll be passionately mistaken. And it'll be because I really believe something. And so what drives me is the belief that that's what I've been put on the planet to do. And so as a consequence, I'm very much want to tell those stories. And I think there's a thing that I tell this story not because I want sympathy or anything like that, but because it did change my life. I kind of thought life was everlasting, and I know that sounds ridiculous, but I couldn't see my end. And then when I had an operation that went wrong, and I had anaphylaxis and died on the operating table, and they brought me back after a few minutes, and that mental realization that actually it's very finite, our time here, and that I'm included in that, not just everybody else. And as a consequence, I then thought, I've got to try and do what I can do every day, because you don't know which is the last day, and you won't know until it happens. And so I decided that I was going to keep doing what I do. I can't imagine retiring. I kind of envy other people that retire and they have lots of spare time to do the garden or whatever it is there, but I'm just not interested in that.
I also had an anaphylactic shock. And yes, and I had an allergy and it changed my life. So I always look at it, I don't know about you, Tony, but I always look at it as that was the beginning of my second life. Is that how you felt?
Yeah, I did. I remember when they woke me up, and at the end of the bed, well, my wife was stroking my head, and I was thinking, like, I don't feel like I've had the operation. And there was a man at the end of the bed, big, big, huge guy, and he was crying. He was a doctor. And I'm like, who is he? I didn't recognise him at all. Why is he crying? And it turned out he was the guy in the next operating theatre on the crash team that had just had their annual training, and he was the guy who came rushing into my operating theatre and jumped on me and started pounding my chest and got me back. And there was a person standing next to me with a notepad and pen, and they were going like, "Did you see a white light? What did you see? What?" I didn't see anything, but I do remember distinctly feeling, A, shocked. I was shocked at what happened, and B, that okay, now I've got a second chance.
If you speak to people who have had these experiences, they are pretty much similar in a lot of ways. It's like I remember asking myself, have I not seen enough flowers? Have I not seen enough trees? What is it? Why did I come back? And I remember my heart saying to me, but you haven't seen it with these eyes.
Good answer.
And I thought, well, I can't beat that answer. And you're never the same. I don't know about you, but I don't even feel the same after that.
Well, I think it adjusted my attitude to a lot of things, and the things that I used to care about, I don't care about, and things I didn't care about, I care about a lot more. And I suppose that was all coloured by that. Yes, I think that's. I feel pretty much the same as you do. And I'm a very strong believer that I know the difference between right and wrong, and I can deal with that. I can deal when something I've done is wrong, but at least I'm not amoral. And when I see people that are amoral, and I go like, I just don't want to be in the same room. Because there's a lot, particularly in certain sort of get rich quick kind of businesses, like they think the film business is, not really, but they think it is. And those people that like, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you get the result you want. And I can't stand those people.
Did that line, I totally agree with you on that. But for me, that line after that experience that I had became much more sharper and much more definitive, where I could look at people and just think, what a load of rubbish you're talking. You're just trying to fleece me, or it's just a load of BS. And not because I was on some high moral ground, but things became clearer. Because when you have this experience of nearly dying, the line between lies and truth is no longer blurred. It's quite certain, isn't it?
Well, I also it made me realize that even if I was getting paid a lot of money, I just don't want to work with certain people. I just don't want a relationship with them. And so, yeah, I think that what motivates me is to tell stories that I think are actually of some use. And that doesn't necessarily come with a pound sign, but it does mean that I think it sort of attracts like-minded people, to be honest. But the things that used to, it's like when you see some people. I remember once when I was entering academia, and one of the students who's since gone on to have quite a successful writing career on episodic television in England, and he said to me on day one, he said, "I can't understand what you're doing here." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've checked you out." He said, "And you must be earning like what, a tenth of what you would earn outside to do this. Why are you doing it?" I said, "Well, because I want to." And he couldn't understand it. He's going, "I wouldn't do your job." I said, "What, you would like to get the benefits of somebody like me telling you how to do your job?" He said, "Yeah, but I don't want to do that job." He said, I just want to earn money." And I thought, we'll go and be a builder or something. You're not a constructive person. And I don't demean the value of other types of people. I can only talk about the kind of person that I am.
And it's important, I think, through life to know who you are.
Yes. And I think that takes time. I think that takes time. I don't think you can really know when you're a youngster. I mean, I started incredibly young in our business. I was 16, and I was making films for myself, the time I was 17 while I was still working for other people. And so I, at the time I was 21, I was on my third or fourth film. And when I look back on it and I think, what did I do? It was like, that was insane. I was like, what was I thinking? But I felt it was the right thing to do. And I've always followed my instinct in that sense. And I think it brought me to the ability to do stuff now that I couldn't have done if I hadn't have started that way. I'm the fulfillment of what I did unconsciously.
Yeah. And I know that it takes time to know oneself, but somehow I think our childhood, and I always believe this, is a promise of our life. I think as children, we do actually know ourselves. Well, and the world then comes along and changes that.
Yeah, well, I think we lose our innocence and our playfulness.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when people used to say to me at school, is there something wrong if I wasn't smiling? Because they used to call, my uncle used to call me Smiler. I was always, two things I was always doing, smiling and asking the question, why? Whatever anybody said, I'd say, why? And it used to drive my mum mad. She said, I don't have to explain everything to you. But it was, I just wanted to know how everything worked. And I was, precocious is probably an understatement. I started the school underground magazine at school when I was 11. I mean,
my goodness.
Yeah, I did. With a colleague, my best friend. And we started this thing, and we were writing all the articles. We were the editors, the publishers. We were running off in his father's gestetta in his office until we got caught, obviously. Then we got in trouble. But it was just something the pleasure I got when there was an alumni society kind of thing on Facebook, one of the groups, and up it came, who was it that published this magazine? And it was my magazine, and it was me.
Oh, how did you feel about that? That someone still remembered that?
Oh, loved it. Yeah. I had got a copy of it, so I was able to print it off from what came through the computer. I just loved the fact. I started writing my first book when I was 13, and gave up when I was 14. But it was, and I've got it here in my cupboard. Somebody said to me, when did you become a professional writer? Well, I got my first prize for writing when I was 8. So I was very precocious, because I thought I could. When I look back, I go, well, what a twat I was. But I'm a twat with ambition.
I'm smiling all the way through this, Tony, because to listen to you, and there's such effervescence in what you say and what you've done, and this sort of indestructible belief in yourself is that really shines through. And I'm convinced, you know, that when someone believes in themselves, really truly, like you say, anything is possible.
Yeah, I don't know about what's that kind of mindfulness type of thing. But I do think there is a degree of truth in that. I think if you think you can, and you apply yourself, you've got to work hard, obviously. And if you have a little bit of talent, doesn't hurt, you can do what it is you want to do. It's the power of the mind with the power of your emotional push of the mind, what makes things possible. I remember once when I was a kid, and I was like the assistant on a unit manager on a little TV series that was on ATV in those days, Midlands Television, called Junior Sports Week. And I was working with this team that we were hired to go film football places, and before the matches, not during the matches. And we went to Liverpool, and they had a manager then called Bill Shankly, who became a legend. And he was pointing to me all the different players, and he said two things. One was, there was a youth sort of match going on. I don't know where they all came from, but there was obviously 11 people on either side. And he said, which one of those do you think is any good? he took a liking to me. And I said to him, and I, not that one, no, not that one, not that. And there was one left. I got it completely wrong. And he said, that one. And I said, but him. And he was the worst player on the pitch, but the most energetic. And he said, anything I tell him, he does it. He said, and he gets better by the second. I'm watching him. He's just getting better and better. And that boy became European Footballer of the Year. His name was Kevin Keegan.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and he was obviously right, and I was obviously wrong. And the other thing he said to me was the difference between a good footballer and a great footballer is in the mind. It's not in the feet. It's what he sees in his imagination. It's those things that no one else can do, and it's like kind of trigonometry, but instant in his feet. And he said, and there's a difference of maybe 1-2%. He said, but that makes a great player, the 1 or 2%. And it's I think, how it works in real life too. It's some people see things in a different way, which is why I would say this. If you had the greatest subject in the world and you got a lousy director, film director, he's going to make it into rubbish. Or you can give the telephone directory to Steven Spielberg and him make something great out of it.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, there's not many of those. But, you know, and the equivalent is Lionel Messi or Ronaldo in football. There's certain people just got magic. And if you've got a little bit of magic, that'll do me.
I think we all have to have that little magic, and we're all born with something within us that is great. And the trick is, like you have done, is to actually realise that magic. And so many people can't.
Well, yeah, and to measure it in a certain way. I tell a story against myself, which is a true story, which is that you have to be true to yourself. You have to listen to your inner self. You don't worry about what other people say. When I was starting out, I was getting very kind reviews and things at a very early age. And then one or two writers started to write about me in the person of my father. So it's like, Michael Klinger's son, Tony, has made this film. And it was kind of like, what's it got to do with him? You know, I've made the film. He was nothing to do with it. And it wasn't because I resented him. I resented that patronising attitude. And then there came a point, my favourite critic story, where a guy who my dad had taught to play cricket at his boys' club, because my dad was head of sport when he was a young man. And this guy wrote the articles on film for Punch magazine that was then existing. And it was a prestigious publication. And he was a jazz player called Benny Green. And Benny was writing about it was my fourth film or fifth film called The Butterfly Ball, which was a thing we did in the Albert Hall. We've been to Price and Twiggy and Deep Purple people and all that kind of thing. And it was a whole mess because they reduced my budget by 4/5 just before we started. So I should have walked away from that and I didn't. And he wrote, the first line of his critique was, I never knew butterflies had balls, but now I know they don't.
Oh.
That was his first line of my kind review. And I made a promise to myself then, I would never read another review.
Yes.
Good or bad, I was too easily influenced by it.
Mm. Mm.
And so from then on in, I didn't really worry what anybody else thought. So I thank Benny. He's gone long gone by now. He was a nice man, really, just as a cheap shot. But I learned the lesson then. And for a long time, and this sounds really strange, for 35 years, I never went to one of my own premieres. I never went to one of the parties for one of the premieres. I never attended anything like that. I stayed away and I just was not worried about those things. And then years and years later, I was in America and a famous marketing lady said, why do you call this company, the coaching company, Pitch Perfect Projects? And I said, well, because I like alliterations. I thought it was a nice name. And she said, look it up on Google while you're talking to me. She was on the phone from New York. And I did. And she said, how many mentions does Pitch Perfect Projects have? And I said, 17. She said, now look up your name. And I looked up my name. It was over a couple of million. And she said, and you've called your thing Pitch Perfect Projects and not Tony Klinger Coaching. And I realised what an idiot I'd been. And so then I changed it, as she said. And the amount of business and business inquiries we had went up 300-400% in a month.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, she was best advice I ever paid for. But it was extraordinary because of how that whole arc of that narrative went from, you know, and it is you have to align a bit of pragmatism, common sense. And if you're making a mistake, don't keep repeating the mistake. Change it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Learn from it. That's the biggest lesson, is if we can learn from the mistake and accept it, because sometimes we're all proud not to want to make a mistake. But some of the biggest mistakes I've made in my life, Tony, have been life-changing to put me on the right path.
Yeah, I think you don't learn from success. I think you learn from failures.
I agree with you. Absolutely. That's absolutely the truth. And one of the things that I think people make the mistake, myself included sometimes, is that we don't want to try in case we fail.
Well, yes.
But I don't think there's an option. I think you have to try.
Yeah, well, if you don't try, I had an intern working for me. I won't obviously name him. He's a nice boy. And he started, in fact, about a week ago. And we needed some technical stuff doing. And so I said, could you do this on a website? And he was, well, I'm a bit uncomfortable about that because I've never done that before. I said, well, no, this would be a learning process. You're an intern. Mm. And I said, but first look at the tutorials that they give for free. And then when you're happy with that, you start doing these little changes. And let me know if there's any problem. I said, are you happy with that? And he went, yes. I said, you sure? Yes, I'm fine. He resigned the next morning. He never did.
Oh.
And I said, it's really strange that I have more faith in you than you have in you. And that's where he could never, ever be a big success. Because the minute he was confronted with a problem, he walked away.
And do you think that maybe some people are just not meant to have a huge success?
Yeah, well, there has to be every type of person, and there's nothing wrong with that. And some people just don't like, it's like me, doesn't bother me at all, confrontation. I'll confront anybody about anything. It doesn't bother me. Or stress doesn't really bother me. I'm told that it does internally, but I don't feel it. So I'm not bothered by that. Or argument never has bothered me, never embarrasses me. But a lot of people, those things they find very, very difficult and can't deal with the consequences of failure. I mean, if you try the things I do and have done, inevitably there will be some failures. You can't always succeed. You know, we voice Spielberg as a tremendous success. He's had some failures. Everybody does.
Yeah, yeah. It's part of being human, I think, that we have to be compassionate to ourselves.
Yeah, and allow that what you might consider a failure in one way might be a success in another. Or you could use one of my favourite films of all time as a very good example, which was Citizen Kane by Orson Welles, which went from being a failure to being a classic without ever having been a success.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it all comes back down to, again, is actually being true to yourself, knowing what your mission is really here, because you knew from a very young age, and I think we all do. And to go back, if sometimes we feel lost, to go back to that point as children and to remember who we were.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that the allowing oneself to be childlike is a very important thing. And sometimes that can get you in trouble, but it's not a terrible way to get in trouble.
I think that's wonderful, is to keep this sort of essence of youth. And my friend's daughter, she always says to me, I'm actually younger than you. I said, well, you can't be younger than me. Well, she is, of course. And I said, I'm actually younger than you. And she said, do you know what, Mimi, I think you actually are. And that keeps us young, is that youthfulness, that belief, that magic, to believe in the magic of life like you do, Tony. That for me, it's like your stories are magic stories, and I could just give 10 subjects, and I know, I'm certain that you would have a story about it.
Yeah, unfortunately, that my mum used to use it as a criticism. You keep telling stories. I went, yes, mum, that's what I do.
That's who I am.
Well, she was a typically Jewish mother. She considered if you had any brain at all, you'd be a doctor. If you were a bit of a failure, you'd be a lawyer. If you're a really dumb ass, you'd be a dentist. Or then if you completely maybe something wrong with you, you could go into business.
Yeah, dentists weren't very favourable, that's true.
Yeah, no,
that's sort of the poor man's doctor. And I'm not saying, because I know my cousin's a dentist and I have friends that are dentists, but
yeah, they never happen. They never happen.
It's the poor man's doctor.
yeah, it's that can you imagine? It's like you're looking into somebody's mouth the whole time. Can't be very pleasant. But yeah, I suppose it pays the bills.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I've never known a poor dentist, I have to say.
No, I never.
Oh, Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here today.
And vice versa, me. It's been great fun.
It's really, oh, how wonderful. And I'd love you to come back again, because I know people are going to say to me, why didn't you ask him about this? And why didn't you ask him about that? But there's not enough time to ask about all these things. So I can only say to everybody out there, I'm going to invite you, please do come back on again.
Anytime, Mimi, I'm there.
Share these beautiful stories. And before we go, for people out there, where can they contact you? And please do say about your films again, what they're called and where they're available from.
Okay, you can contact me on my, I'll give an email address, which is tdklinger with a K, all one word, @aol.com.
And okay.
My films that are out right now on Amazon's probably the easiest one. I'll probably get shot for saying that, but it's on Amazon, is the film Sisters, story of some women in an orchestra in Afghanistan, which is actually really worth watching. And The Man Who Got Carter, which is my love letter to my father, which is also on Amazon and very, very cheap to acquire. And it's worth a watch. I think you'll like it. I love it. You might like it.
I'm going to watch. I'm going to put it down and watch it, especially now. That I know the story behind it. And what about your books?
Oh, well, I've got Who Knows is coming out in the first quarter of next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story about me making the film with The Who called The Kids Are All Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's another book called How to Get Into the Movie Industry by somebody who knows, and that's by me, obviously. And that comes out in the second quarter. Then there's the third book will be the definitive and final book about Get Carter, which is me closing that chapter. And then that'll be the third quarter. And the fourth quarter is, the beginning of the fourth quarter, is one of my novels coming out called Alsatia, The Search for Treasure.
Oh.
And that's an out-and-out adventure novel based on a real thing that happened in a real part of London in the 17th century.
Well, that sounds very interesting, actually.
I'll send you a digital copy so you can read it.
Please do. Please. Now, that all of them have got my interest, and that now has got my interest especially. But what about a website, Tony?
I have lots of websites. Should I give you my Linktree address so they can see them all?
Yeah, of course, of course. That would be a very good idea. And then for people out there who want to have a look, they can do so by following the link. That would be an excellent idea.
Hold on a second, because I'm just getting up because I can't remember it. It's very complex. It's not very complex. I'm exaggerating. It starts off HTTPS with two dots, well, over like a umlaut thing, two dots to each other, and then two lines next to each other, you know, like forward lines.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you have LINKTR. And then you have one forward line. And then you have EE dot TonyKlinger.com, I think.
And there's things on there, as well as even if they just Google you, you're going to be all over the internet anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, they can find out more.
There's lots more. One second, let me just double check that address thing I just gave you. Just want to. So I'm not misleading anyone. Here we go. I should be prepared with this, shouldn't I? Really? That's it. Okay, here we go. It is. I picked the one thing to have it on. Here we go. I'll repeat it. HTTPS, two dots, one on top of each other, then two forward stroke lines. Then LINKTR, so it's Linktr, dot EE forward slash Tony Klinger. That's it.
That's rather good. Is it worth doing the Linktree for people out there?
Yeah.
As in if they want to have it for their business or whatever.
I think so, yes. Because what was happening was I had so many different links that people were finding me at. They said, can't you put it in one place and then someone tell me about Linktree? And I put it out there, and it's got some podcasts, it's got some bits and bobs, it's got my three of my websites and all kinds of
things.
And
it's easy to put together, is it, Tony?
Yeah. Well, it's easy if you've got a tech team.
Well, yeah.
I think it is quite easy. It's one of those things that sometimes things are actually worthwhile, and I think it is.
I've seen it, and I know a lot of people use it, and I've contemplated it, but I'm not very technically minded, so I would have to get somebody else to do it for me.
Well, that's right. If you click on it now, what I've just given you, see if it works. Well, it does work, I know it works. What you find is it's all very neat and it's much easier. And then a person can just say, I'm not interested in that bit. I only want to look at this bit. In fact, that's what we're doing right now with all our websites, is we're simplifying them. We found we had too much information on them.
Oh, okay. Now I'm going to go onto your Linktree now.
Go on then. Go on, I dare you.
I'm going to. So all the listeners can know it does work. Oh, yes, it looks very nice and clean and very nice.
And then you go into the things you're interested in.
Oh, yes. Oh, this is very good.
Yeah, it's very good, I think.
That's such a good idea, because then whatever the person is interested in, so say, for example, your podcasts or your films or your books or your coaching, can be directed from this one sort of source.
That's right. Because if somebody who's interested in my books may not have any interest in films, or vice versa, or coaching person says, I don't know interest in what he does, I want interest in what I do. And so, yeah, that's exactly the reason for it.
I have to say, this looks very, very good.
Yeah.
I like this. I'm looking at your coaching now, and it says about people have 10 seconds to make a impression, good or bad.
That's right.
I believe that. If I see somebody, I know within 10 seconds, am I going to get on with them or not?
Well, it's also, you know, that happens in any relationship, you know.
Yeah.
Friendship, sexual, whatever, you know instantly, yeah, that's somebody I would like to be with or not. And it's almost instant.
I can absolutely recommend it. I'm looking at it now and it looks rather good, I have to say. And there's all sorts of things there about filmmaking, producing, writing. It's very good, Tony.
Thank you. And it has lots of testimonials. None of them are fake. You can trust me on that. They're all real. And our reaction, the reactions to it have been really nice. And it's something, again, I have to ration my time, but it's something I really enjoy doing because I can see what a difference it makes to people.
I love it. And your Instagram is fantastic, I have to say. It has some very good quotes on there. And
thank you.
Would you rather deal with a fool or a villain? Wow.
That was when my dad was testing me to find out if I was growing up.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Oh, thank you so much, Tony, really. And I wish you all the best with the films and the books. And I look forward in having you back again.
Be my pleasure. And I look forward to getting to know you, Mimi. It's a pleasure.
Oh, and likewise. You're such a delight. You're such an interesting person. But as I said to you, next time me and you speak, I'm going to have a list of things. And I know I said to Tony, and you're the fixer. You know everything about everything. You're my go-to person now.
Well, I don't think I am, but I'm at least a good guide.
That's all that matters. That's all that matters in the end.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mimi. Thank you for a very, very interesting afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of the evening.
Thanks again.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Tony Klinger, what a fascinating gentleman. And what stories he has. Wonderful. Thank you, as always, for joining me today. And I really do appreciate all of your support. And until next time, look after yourselves and have beautiful, beautiful moments. Take care and lots of love.
Thank you for listening to Secrets for an Inspirational Life, brought to you by your host, Mimi Novick. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and see you in the next episode. For more information about Mimi Novick and her books, music, and inspirational work, take a look at her website, www.miminovick.co.uk.